Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step by step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Welcome to Sodcast number 3. My name's John Stryker Meyer, and we're recording today courtesy of Jocko Willink. And we want to thank Jocko and his team for the support. Today, we are joined by our guest, a fellow SOG Recon man, Nick Brockhausen. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tucker. I'm glad to be here.
Indeed. So this will be one of our more informative as well as entertaining interviews. We've been looking forward to it for a while. Anyways, I'd like to start off with reading from the first of Nick's 3 books. And again, these are books that are not only are they well-written, but they document our SOG missions during your tour of duty. And what was the total time at CCN, Nick, for the second and third tours?
I think it was like 17 months.
You know, on the ground.
On the ground.
Yes. And so we had the Secret War for 8 years. We had, by 1970, we had 3 operational bases, one down south at CCS, one at CCC, Khantoum, and then CCN North at Da Nang. And you landed there in the fall of 1970?
Right.
And so the first book I'm going to go to stems from the mission.
We refer to it as I was sentenced there in the fall of 70.
Indeed. So the first book that Nick has written that came out years ago has been reprinted, thankfully, and it is We Few. Again, excellent, tight writing, stories about the missions. And also, there's a lot of reflections about the unique relationship between Green Berets and the indigenous troops they work with. In this case, your brew on that team, R.T. Habu.
Right.
I like that. It's got a rhyme. The brew from R.T. Habu.
R.T. Habu. Okay, never mind. We can make a good rap song out of that.
We could do that. The second book, we have Whispers in the Tall Grass, which is also available. Both are available on Amazon. And another read that continues on with more of the stories later into the tour of duty. And so today we will be focusing on these books, the stories, the man behind them, the unique personality. And fortunately for our readers that like the first 2 books, we have a third book that is in the process of being produced. Vagabonds, Tourists in the Heart of
Darkness.
Darkness. And that's just the perfect headline for another book that will go into missions that you ran and stories.
It's basically the adventures I had with 2 or 3 of my other friends from Special Forces for 40 years after we left the service. But before there were contractors that were vagabonds. People that went out there and basically built the industry.
Indeed.
That, you know, that later became, you know, Blackweiser and all the other companies.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah. So in We Few, one of the, well, there's many compelling stories here, but there's one mission where your team is getting inserted into the DMZ.
If I can interject something.
Please, and stay close to the mic.
Yeah, most people don't understand. I did not write these books as a great American novel, and they aren't. It's not an archival. It's not something that, you know, somebody's going to go look up and for research for their PhD. I wrote these books as a catharsis. I was going through a difficult time in my life. I went back to basically spend time with the guy I'd spent the 2 years running recon with. And during that time, I wrote these two books. And I wrote them as a tribute to the people that I knew in that outfit and the people that had gone before me and came after me, for that select group of men. That was all they were written for. It wasn't really written for the general public. I'm pleased that the general public finds them entertaining or informative. But the books are really written for my peers. And the highest accolade I can get is from somebody who actually ran recon and goes, "Wow, you're a man, you're spot on." That's better than getting the Pulitzer Prize.
Indeed, I know the feeling. And as a peer, Nick arrived at CCN after I left a few months later.
Yeah, all that bad shit happened after he left.
Indeed. And as a peer, fellow recon guy, this book is amazing. Each book is one I've gone back to reread, because they're not only is it rewritten well, but the stories are compelling, and the way you articulate the relationship with the men you serve with, from the Special Forces side, but even more detailed information that I've seen anywhere on the relationship between a Green Beret and his indigenous troops.
Oh, yeah.
Which is outstanding. And so I wanted to start off with one of the chapters from We Few, where on this mission, R.T. Habu is going into the DMZ. And could you just lay out, because on a team, and this team was just the two Americans, you and Mac, and explain who Mac is and the 1011, and then how many little people you had. And when we say little people, we say that with the term of endearment.
Great endearment. Great
indeed.
Endearment.
Or talking about our indigenous people that, in your case, your brew.
In fact, I mean, like the brew team leader had been fighting the communists for 9 years. Nine straight years. They'd butchered his family, you know, and he hated the communists. And he was, while he was subordinate to our command, he was also a mentor to us on teaching us, you know, survival skills, combat skills, and how to operate working with the brew and that. He was actually, I think the closest thing you could call it would be like a war chief in one of the plains tribes, like the Crow, the Dog Soldiers, or something like that. You know, he basically was the most effective combat leader amongst the brew and was treated as such. And we treated him like that. But he a lot of times would give us advice. You know, like one time when he was always amused about the fact that we always made Captain Manus very angry.
And Captain Manus was the CEO of Recon Company of CCN at that time.
And I remember one time he was chewing us up, Mac and I. He goes, "Osh, number 10. All time make Captain Manus buku angry." And he pointed at his testicles and he said, "This is not the thinking organ." Simple philosophy.
But wisdom, profound wisdom.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, a lot of times we got that. I mean, we had, not to get too far afield.
That's
that.
Okay.
The Montagnards are a very special people. They were essentially an Iron Age tribal unit. And there were, I used to have a great book and somebody stole it from me. And if you're out there, I'm going to eventually remember who you are. And it was all the ethnic groups of Vietnam. It's about that thick. You know, Army Field Manual with the vanilla cover, you know. And it outlined every tribe, what their marriage ceremonies were like, what the taboos were, how they were marked, what kind of clothing they wore. I mean, all that. But the Montagnards were the hill people. Montagnard means mountain people in French. So it's right. and they were considered by the Vietnamese, both the North and the South, to be less than human. And they did their dead level, like a Montagnard in the South Vietnamese Army couldn't be an officer. They could be NCOs, but they couldn't be an officer. They could be an officer in the North Vietnamese Army, but not in the South. But both sides tried to eradicate them as a people, both before the war and after the war. You know, they were the people that North Vietnamese used yellow rain on, you know, and nerve gas, and tried to eradicate the people of the highlands. So, but they were very special to us. They were absolutely excellent fighters, the finest you could find.
Totally fearless.
And totally fearless. Well, when you say fearless, most of us that are combat veterans know that term is overused.
Right.
You know, it's controlling your fears. You know, could they control their fear better than most people? Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. More accurate. I say I like that.
Yeah.
And so on this mission, you still haven't explained who Mac is.
Okay. So McLaughlin was the 1-0. The 1-0 is a recon team leader. When Snake Adams went home and Danzer took over Habu as the 1-0, the very next mission they ran was the recovery for Doc Watson and baby son Lloyd to try and get their bodies back in that. And after that was over, Horton, who had been wounded really bad, there was Danzer, Horton, and Mac, and I think Jimmy Johnson was still on the team at that. So he was like the 1-3 or 1-4. Right. And when they went in to get Doc Watson and baby son Lloyd, they found the bodies hanging in the trees where the strings had separated.
Right.
They looked like they were asleep. They were only about 20 yards out.
Yeah, and that was the mission where the chopper was extracting.
Right.
Had the SF men hanging from the rope. Sammy Hernandez,
right.
His rope broke. He fell.
He's the only one to survive.
Only one to survive. Yeah. He was knocked unconscious, separated right. Shoulder. As the helicopter further lifted out, it was hit with something. It turned around and crashed into the granite face or a mountain, killing everybody.
Right.
And this is where Habu went in for a bright light, which is a right. Mission to recover down teams, or in this case, bodies.
Right. So after they ran that mission, Mac took over as the 1-0 or the recon team leader, and I became the 1-1. Now there were two other guys that were in the interim there. There was a guy named Steve Hink, and Steve, I'm sorry I didn't put you in the books. You should have been in there, and a guy named Ken Holmes that were also on Habu at that time. Ken eventually went up to become an AST.
Right.
Up at the top, and was one of the best they had up there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But Habu essentially then became cored out with Lemuel McLaughlin, Mini Mac, or the Combat Pygmy, and Cookie, Robert Cook, and myself. And the three of us ran the longest time together.
So sure.
Mac was the team leader. Mac's job was to have the radio. The radio stayed with him so he could talk to Covey. My job was to fight the team as a unit. Between Cook and I, we basically fought the team as a unit.
Yeah.
And then Mac took care of the radio, because I have a tendency when I'm hyperventilating to stutter on the radio. And Cook's from Georgia, and you know how they are. Nobody can understand them.
You know.
So
indeed.
Mac got it.
So on this particular mission, the first helicopter goes in, Mac gets off, and as your helicopter, you're on the second helicopter, as it's descending, reading from the book now, We Few. We aren't even on short final when I hear the pilot screaming, "Abort! Abort!" I look down where Mac landed and get sick to my stomach. He's lying on his back, and right next to him is the trap door to a bunker concealed right at the crest of the trail. He has fallen on it and plugged the door. There are two NVA trying to crawl out of a side entrance, and the yards shoot them. Worse yet, I can see about 15 other likely bunkers upslope on the opposite side. I am standing on a skid, and I feel the ship start to gain power. I instinctually know that they are going to abort and pull up, which will leave Mac with too few men to save himself. I slam the barrel of my Car 15 in the back of the pilot's head and his helmet. And I scream into the mic, "Put this fucking bird down where he is now." He chops power. Other words, he reduces power. We slam into the slope. We all jump in and are thrown clear. I land heavily. When I hit the ground, my ears feel like I just ripped them off. I still feel the headset when I jumped. The bird screams loudly as it winds up and is gone. Immediately, I get the yards in some sort of fighting perimeter where we can at least hold on or fight our way to better ground. I run up in a crouch, and Max says, "Why did you land?" "I told them to abort."
He did.
There are bunkers all over the hill to our right, and eight of us can fight a lot harder than five, I yell back. He grabs the radio handset. "Go tie in the team and let me bring in some air." In this case, bring in tactical air. I work my way downslope where I see Zompot, team member, stand up and fire methodically. He fires like he is on the rifle range. He is standing upright, just like we did at the range. It is almost amusing because he looks like a poster child for the NRA. I think he's shooting at nothing. He is new on the team, and this is his first mission. I yell at Bob and Tua to see what he's firing at. A grenade goes off over by where Tua is, and he yells at the team because he thinks one of the team has thrown it, and it fell short. I run over to where Zapod is, and down the trail, I see the crumpled bodies of three NVA with a whole shitload of canteens on bamboo poles lying amongst their bodies. They had just walked up the trail. He just stood up, yelled something like, "Hey!" and dropped all three. That's pretty good discipline. Or he just got lucky. We are starting to take ground fire now, and the tempo is picking up. I run back up slope. Well, I trudge up slope-like. I use the team to tie in closer, and I am working my way back up to where Mac is beside the bunker. Nearby, I can see a group of NVA in green khakis break from cover by some rocks to his left front. They start to try to flank him. Kuman and Bong drop all of them, who make it to a small wash below. Mac. Kuman throws a grenade down into just as a stick grenade comes lofting out of the wash, lands where Mac is, and explodes. I hear Mac scream, "God damn it!" That's just unbelievable.
Well,
how did Mac do with that?
Well, you know, let me start with DM-10.
Indeed.
DM-10 is Demilitarized Zone Number 10 Target. And the terrain is an old caldera, like the inside of a crater.
Mm-hmm.
With overgrown brush on the top and a trail that ran down through the center of it. We knew there was a division plus in that area. And what I didn't know at the time, but Mac knew, and he didn't want to inform me because he knows that I have delicate feelings, was that they were inserting two other teams to try and... The whole concept was basically stir them up till they get up on the radio and they start talking so they can RDF them. Call back to Guam, roll out the B-52s. They get a pedicure on the way over and bomb the place into snot. You know? And there were air packages that were prepared for the other two teams that were on the outside and adjacent to our no-bomb box of 6x6. I didn't know this at the time, which is why when the cavalry showed up, we had everything. We had A-1Es, we had fast movers, we had the choppers, you know, I think I even saw Air Nook Mom go by. But there was a lot of air available to us that day. And our mission was to go in and basically try and stir them up. get them up out of the hole. We knew that they, and we went in at pock time every day in Vietnam between such an hour and such an hour.
Similar siesta time.
It's like siesta time in Mexico. So they were at pock time. We landed right in the middle of their Nook Mom lunch. And all hell broke loose. Because when they came in, Mac bailed out on the right-hand side. And he hit the opening to the bunker, and it caved in underneath him. So he's laying on his back like a ninja turtle, scrambling around. And I didn't know it, but he had told the lift, abort, 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 because he realized there was no reason to bring more people in there. We were all going to die. Well, he's on the ground with three people, not five, himself and two other yards. And I had myself in 4 yards on my chopper. So, you know, there was no time to explain to the pilot that, who, by the way, I met later, years later. And he goes, oh, yeah, I remember you. You're the crazy son, but stuck a gun in the back of my head. I shoved a gun. There was no way to get the immediacy across to him. I had to threaten him. So I stuck the gun in the back of his helmet, land a chopper now. And the reason was, it was getting ready to turn very bad, and Mac and the other 2 yards were dead unless we got on the ground. So we got on the ground, and, you know, it just, when I said it was pock time, everybody was awake 5 minutes later and shooting at us. You know, I remember looking up, when you look at the terrain there, it's a huge, just imagine a crater wall that's been eroded, and the center cone has been eroded, and where we were was in that center cone. And that's where there was, like, within 20 meters, there were 4 bunkers, all of them manned by NVA. And on the slopes where everybody woke up, there must easily another 100 to 150 just on that one side that suddenly woke up and started shooting at us. Then they couldn't get at us because we got into a gully. And we finally rolled down into that because we were taking fire from everywhere. We rolled down into this gully, and they started organizing so they could mass on us. Because they know if they don't mass on us, the Air Force is going to come and blow everything into smithereens. So the whole idea is get on top of you, grab you by the belt buckle, and stay with you. So about that time, you know, they came up, they started throwing grenades uphill at us. And one of the grenades went off right next to where Mac was. Well, I'm trying to tie in the team and get her. I can't do anything on the ground. The guy who's killed more people in this world is the guy who invented hit the dirt. Because you can't see anything from the dirt. You've got to get up and move. If you can't get up, shoot, move, and communicate, you're dead. So I'm up doing what I'm supposed to do, which is fight the team. And I go back up and I'm going, oh my God, that landed right where Mac was. So I went up to check on him, and he's got the handset cupped in his hand like this. He's leaning against his rucksack, and he's got his pants down, and he's handling his junk. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, this is the coolest son of a bitch in the world. We're in the middle of a firefight, and he's masturbating. Well, what had happened, the grenade had gone off. And it nicked him on the inside of his thigh right next to his junk and that. And he was just checking to make sure the equipment was there.
Didn't want any brain damage.
No brain damage. Yeah. Right, yeah. So he looks at me like, you know, what are you looking at? And Covey keeps calling, you know, calling us, saying, where do you want to, you know, where do you want us to lay it in and that? And I took the handset away from him. I said, you'll have to give him a minute because my 1-0 is busy fondling himself and I think he may be masturbating. So, and Dick Cheney was the Covey, and he's going, well, we'll take that into account. Put him back on the line.
Oh, man.
So it was a bad target, a lot of bad people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had...
Let me just go, because this is the next couple of paragraphs. You're still there. We both look upslope to our east, and the platoon we had driven to ground has been joined by about 10 more Stallard lads and is getting ready to assault us. The yards are dropping them like they were ducks in a shooting gallery. But the small arms fire isn't slacking off at all. We are getting heavy fire from both sides now, and I can count at least 6 bunker openings and with muzzle flashes. Some of them are only 40 yards away. Mother McRae, this is bad, bad, bad. We are tucked into a warse, so they can't really get at us. But if they can lay enough fire on us, they will be able to keep our heads down. Then they will hit us with the B-40s and rushes. That will be the end of R.T. Habu. The end of my dreams of becoming president and any dreams I have of ever becoming a porno star. Mac yells at me. The guns are on the way. The slicks are about 10 minutes out. Hang on. Oh no, Red Rider. I think I will just give up. Maybe they won't put me in a tiger cage with someone who is more interested in his future as a breeding stud. Crump, crump. The high explosives go off west about 50 meters. Oh, great. Someone brought a mortar to the party. How novel. Now we are all really fucked. They can reach us in the warrants with that. I'm trying to figure out some great tactical wizardry that will allow me to get out of this alive. But all I can come up with is becoming invisible. I look over at the torn bodies of the two NVA we shot coming in. I am wondering if I can fit into one of the uniforms.
I did.
And slip away into the crowd. I'm wondering. I remember reading how some plainsmen had escaped from a war party of Sioux by crawling inside a dead horse carcass and concealing himself. I look around. Nope. There aren't any horse carcasses here. But there are plenty of pissed off Indians, and they are starting to get organized. I hear the unmistakable brrrr of a minigun, and the slope in front of me erupts, causing bunches of the green khaki tribe go down. Rockets and 40 mic mics start hitting the slope to the rear. I have my IRC-10 emergency radio, and I can hear Covey talking to another ship that has been hit and gone down. The crew is out, and slicks from the package are dropping in to pick them up. The Cobras bank up and to the right, and a pair of Spads come in, guns chewing up the real estate. Get down, Nape, Mac yells. I didn't see the canister drop, but then a rolling firestorm erupts in front of us and envelops any of the survivors of the assault force who were splashing into the bunkers. There is a blast of heat behind me, and I can hear someone screaming. It is too far away to be one of us. Fry, you little rice-eating ant. Napalm sucks oxygen out of the area, making it hard to breathe. I don't notice because when I'm scared shitless, I have a tendency to hyperventilate. So oxygen isn't yet a problem. The mortar has stopped. Maybe we got lucky.
Very lucky.
Incredible writing, too.
Well, what most people don't understand, I mean, it sounds like some action movie, but people don't understand the concentrations that the North Vietnamese had in the demilitarized zone at that time. They were moving divisions south, and they had base camps, they had bunker systems, they had refit facilities. I mean, all, and our job was to find them. We had to, you know, our specific mission, we were trying to find a pipeline that they were supplying their tanks. Because we were seeing T-54 tanks south of the demilitarized zone.
And this is 1970 or 70, early 71 then?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there was, you know, the Soviet tank normally carries a 55-gallon drum on the back. Actually, they're 44-gallon drums that are on the back, two of them, for spare fuel supply. And they also used diesel fuel. They injected on top of the heads and create a smoke screen, using the exhaust and that. But none of the tanks were showing up with those extra fuel tanks on the back, so they had to be getting fuel from somewhere. And if they weren't bringing it down by the trucks, then we had to figure out how they were getting the fuel, and that's when we eventually stumbled onto the pipeline that they had run from, actually there were three of them, three pipelines.
Three? Were they all in the DMZ?
They came one skirted over through Laos and came down
into the MA
target. Yeah, one came down to the DMZ, and I think one of them really went way around and down south and actually entered almost just above where CCC's northern boundary was for their AO.
Okay.
But the reason we were there was basically that you're doing in recon, find out what the other guy is up to. We knew there was high concentrations in there, but when you read that particular chapter, it sounds like, you know, there's thousands of people against us. Well, the North Vietnamese are like the Germans in World War II. You beat the snot out of them and then sit down to reload, they're going to come back with a counterattack. And that's just what they did. As soon as we hit them and we landed in the middle of their Nook Mom party, they got organized immediately and started putting maneuver troops on us from out of those bunker systems. And what I found out later was all the air that had been laid on by Pappy Boudreau and the other people in the launch site was actually in preparation because they figured we were going to get our tit in a ringer and we were going to need all the air support that we had, which is the keynote of this chapter is basically the use of combined arms, which is something that we developed in Vietnam and is still used today. Air power and overwhelming technology makes up, it's a force multiplier. You can use a small group of people to do more than a division could do. You know, eventually the projects, we made the North Vietnamese redirect 50,000 troops just to take care of us. That's 50,000 troops that weren't fighting our troops on the battlefield and weren't invading the South. They were there specifically to protect their logistical lines from Amal and the night visitors, which would be us.
Indeed.
Yeah. but it was a tough target. And I ran DM-10 four times.
Four times?
Four times.
And all for a fuel line?
No. And you're talking about, it was a major headquarters. I mean, that whole wall, north and eastern wall, was nothing but bunkers and tunnel systems and everything. I mean, I don't think anybody really got in there and did a survey of it unless, you know, the Cuban snuck in there looking for porno magazines. He might have gone through the tunnels. But it was a real developed complex. They had storage caves. They had bunker systems for, and they had a major coaxial cable that was connecting everything, and they had any aircraft everywhere, 37mm, 57mm, laid down all to 12.5, all protecting that area. It's a key area. Obviously, we wanted to know what was going on in it. So we went in DM-10, DM-9, and I think DM-6 was just above that. Those three targets, I ran DM-10 four times, and my cumulative time on the ground was less than 3 hours.
Oh my God. And everyone was like this. Every one of them was like this.
I mean, this was the worst one, was the one with Mac. But yeah, I mean, I remember one time we got in, our total time on the ground was like 16 minutes. And by the time 16 minutes were up, I had expended half the ammunition I had taken in with me.
So yeah. Did you ever find any, the fuel line?
I think it was Jesse Campbell and Keith Larson and McDowell.
Was Jesse the 1-0 with Idaho?
Yeah.
I think
they were the ones that found the pipeline the first time.
I had to give Jesse a call.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know. The thing with Jesse is don't talk to him on the radio because it takes him a while to explain what's going on.
But he gets the job done eventually.
Yeah, well, in the second book, there's a chapter about called The Night Before Christmas.
And we will get to that shortly.
About him and Larson and McDowell. McDowell.
But like another aspect of We Few, your first book, Nick, I want to get back to the story because one of the things you capture here is the action and the sense of what it's like to be on the ground. And then you throw in a couple of your little twists, your little editorials of what you're thinking while on the ground, while under fire. And finally, like you said, for those four times you're in that target, you're only there for 3 hours. And in this case, your first time in, Mac, the 1-0, tells you, hey, the birds are on the way. So you're checking things out and you're going to be out in the first slick. So I'll take it from here in the book. The first slick comes in. Slams down about 10 yards from me. I run toward it and start throwing little people on board. I'm about to dive in when it is suddenly up and gone. I stand there, momentarily with feelings of despair, betrayal, and a big, oh shit. However, I haven't got time for hurt feelings. I have to get back to where Mac is, or they will leave me here, and all these pissed off people will blame me for ruining their lunch hour. I run over to Mac, and the second bird slams into the ground, almost on top of us. We dive inside. Kuman lands on top of me, and we start to lift. The door gunners on both sides are burning their guns out on full auto, and they have plenty to shoot at. The NVA are trying to get right on top of us because the guns and the SPADs are killing everything except what is about 20 yards from the chopper we are on. You can feel the rounds hitting the chopper. A staccato metal thunk, thunk, thunk. From where I am lying on the floor, I can see an NVA officer running at us with a pistol and yelling at his men. Shit, this boy must have watched too many war movies. I wonder how he can run that far, that fast. Having such big balls, I just don't know how he did it. I can't get my gun up because I'm half lying on it. So I just pulled the trigger and let it rip. We are lifting, and I can't see if I got him. A grenade flies in. Mac kicks it, and it rumbles out the side of the bird. Another grenade bounces off the gunner's helmet and falls out. The gunner swats at his face with one hand, like he's shooing away some nasty bug, but keeps burning up the gun with one long, continuous burst. The engines are screaming up to full power, and I can see rounds chewing up the overhead and inside the bird. Then we are up and away. There is another sudden rush of hot air from ordnance going off real close, and the chopper jumps up from the concussion. But we are still gaining altitude, pulling free, and getting some sky, getting up and beyond the 12.5 millimeters and all those other weapons trying to pull us back down.
Oh, yeah.
Just another day in SOG.
Well, I mean, you know, it sounds like it's unique, but it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, you ran missions the same way. You know, the idea that you have an overview of everything that's going on in combat, that's bullshit. You see what's in your immediate vicinity, and then talking to others, you eventually put together the whole picture in that. But most of what I remember of that target is confusion, fear, anger, and
buku enemy.
And it was a lot. It was a lot. I saw, you know, like I said, when I said they were rushing us, when that NVA officer came up, he had about eight guys with him that were still standing. The door gunners had chopped up the formation that he was leading in that, but he had about eight guys still with him, and to this day, I admire his courage.
Oh, yeah.
He stood there like with that Marikov pistol and was firing at us, and I think he's the one that threw the grenade that Mac kicked out.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, the guy was hard charger, man. He was, and my gun was laying underneath me, so I just reached down with my thumb. It was like sticking out in front of my face like that. It was pointing at him, so I just pulled the trigger. Bad move because I couldn't hear shit afterwards.
Right.
From the gun and that. And I think Kuman may have nailed him. You know, he was right next to me, and I heard him firing. But the guy to this day, hey, here's to you, Nugent. I hope you made it.
Indeed.
You certainly deserved it.
Yeah. Well, at that point, in your early time at CCN, you were still carrying a car 15 before you transferred over to an RPD later in your time, right?
To do what?
You were carrying a car 15. Later, well, months later,
I,
you were
I never
carrying...
transferred to the RPD. We had an RPD in
on a team.
On the team.
Okay, I wasn't sure. That's why I asked.
It sawed off our RPD, which that right. little conniving Cuban stripped all the parts out.
And then we got to give the conniving Cuban a little ink here. Yeah. That's Bob Castillo.
Bob Castillo.
From, at that time, RT Idaho also.
Yeah.
A real troublemaker.
Well, you know,
but a hell of a recon.
That team had a certain ambiance in the criminal side.
They did.
Yeah, everybody had different weapons in that. And I love the S4. You'd go up there and go, I want a Swedish K with a silencer. I'd give you one. I want six Thompsons and a case of 45 ammunition because I'm feeling a little belligerent today. I want to go to the raid. You got it.
Yeah.
You know? But they had the RPD, and the RPD was great. Sawed off. It slowed down the cyclic rate of fire a bit because when you cut it off just ahead of the gas port. But it produces a gout of blue-green plasma out the end of it that scares the shit out of everybody, especially at night. But the problem with the RPD was links, because the RPD uses a continuous belt. It's hooked to, see, the M60 and the 242, they use a disintegrating link. In other words, when the round is fed into the chamber,
right,
and it ejects, that link is thrown out. And you can put a belt together by putting those little links together. But with the RPD was like the German. They had the half moon link.
Right.
And then you just slid the shells in it. And they were hard to get. So everybody carried something to put your used belts in as you used them up. I kept a Claymore bag that would broke out on the side so I could shove the used links in there. And I carried the RPD on specific targets.
Okay. If
we were doing a bright light.
Right.
I carried the RPD. We needed the firepower.
No food, no water.
No food, no water. You're not going to need that. You're not going to be here long enough for that. Just one survival ration, usually a PIR that you kept in a inner thigh pocket to keep it hot. And water, but none of the extra rations. You're going in, you want every grenade and every round of ammunition you can get. So when I carried the RPD, I also carried a CAR-15 at the same time.
Is that right?
I carried the RPD, and I had one, two, three fully round loaded drums on me, hanging on me, and one in the gun, and then I carried a CAR-15 slung in the back, and an AK vest with six magazines in it, 30-round magazines, because eventually you're going to run out of ammo on the. Because everybody on the team carried an extra belt for that machine gun.
Right.
So I had on the ground somewhere around 1,500 rounds belted up if I needed them.
Oh, yeah.
And I had another, you know what, six times 30, 180 rounds
for the car
15. I switched from the car because somebody stole my sawed-off shotgun. I taught myself how to load the RPD with one hand, reload it.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed something other than a pistol to protect myself when I was doing that. So I'd gotten an old coach gun, 12-gauge double barrel.
Right.
And the Filipinos up there sawed it off and made a like extension for your wrist and that, so it took the shock up. And I kept that in a slide holster behind my back. And I carried 25 rounds of shotgun for it. Most of them double-aught buck and slug.
Right.
Yeah.
Because if you need it, if while you're changing magazines, you have...
Somebody runs up on you, you got to have something to defend yourself. I actually ended up taking the 12-gauge shells apart. And instead of putting double-aught buck in there, I started putting either nickels or the 10 dong piece.
Right.
The brass 10 dong piece actually held together really well when you fired it. And it inside 8 feet, it would cut a man in half. I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
You know, it will kill a man and cut him in half. One barrel.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but, different weapons for different missions, yeah.
Well, I want to go to your second book for a couple more chapters here. And the second book, of course, we're talking about Whispers in the Tall Grass. Chapter 5, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So set us up a little bit about what the night before Christmas, what the mission was,
right,
and then how Jesse Campbell's enters into your experience there.
First of all, I want everybody to know that I no longer correspond with any of the people in that team. I don't hang out with them. They don't come to my family affairs, and most of them are still down south. All right, RT Idaho, good team. Jesse Campbell was the
1-0 at the time.
1-0. I think McDowell was the 1-1. Now, George McDowell, if you can imagine somebody who has all the temperament of a gutshot Wolverine and a stick of dynamite. Perfect good description of him. If he's not breaking something, he's destroying something, punching somebody out. Really good recon guy.
Yeah.
Keith Larson, who's from my home state of Minnesota. Really, really nice guy. Another good recon man. And I think Mariano or Ramonde, one of the two was on there. And anyway, they get the mission to go out there, and it's ecstatic. They're going to sit on top of a hill and become a carbuncle in the North Vietnamese supply chain. Get there, they got to eventually mass on them, run them off. So they're on top of this hill. They get set up, they go in, they naped it, they prepped it with the guns. They realized when they got on the top that there had been a major unit there. It hadn't been a couple of trail watchers, because they found 20 or 30 bodies on the top of the hill. And they were all dressed in the same uniform, had the same markings and that, so they knew that they'd hit the gold mine, so to speak. Now, where they were at, you could see a major trail connection for the Ho Chi Minh Trail going, I think it's Highway 91 east of the Ashau, in that area there, and they were moving troops down.
Right.
So they get up there, they get set up, and they end up calling what we call a World Series. A World Series is an emergency radio call to let everybody in the command know, I have more
targets
than a regiment in the open as a target. Bring me help. So they called a World Series. There was an entire North Vietnamese regiment moving down this trail system. And on top of that was a special group that were all dressed in gray fatigues, and that were obviously Caucasians.
No kidding.
Either East Germans or Cubans or Russians, or what? Because the North Vietnamese used a lot of East Germans and Russians and Cubans as their advisors for their anti-aircraft.
And Chinese.
And Chinese. Well, Chinese are in everything.
You know? Yeah.
There was one special group that was moving down in the open where they could see them that had gray fatigues on. And Don Audie Murphy was flying Covey. To understand Murphy, one needs to dig deep into the dark side. Murphy's up there flying around his motorized sports car and that, you know, and he's directing airstrikes for him. And about the time they get going and they're starting to really lay in airstrikes on this regiment in the open, out of the woods trundles a T-54 tank, which was part of the reason we were looking for pipelines, was that tank had no spare tanks on it.
Right.
It had no 55-gallon drums on the back of it. It was obviously far enough down. They were getting fuel for somewhere. And they destroyed that tank with airstrikes. And then, of course, Da Nang interrupts in the middle of everything to tell them that they want the team to go down there and get some pieces off that tank.
Pieces,
you know, to get the gun sights, you know, get us something to bring back that we can brag to the girls in the club, I guess, you know. And, of course, you know, McDowell's trying to suppress Jesse's, you know, tell Jesse to do something, it gets done, you know. So he didn't want to go down the valley, and the yards are all going, we go to the tank, we no come back, we die down there. So they scratch going down to the tank and getting souvenirs for it. And they worked that perfectly. One of the problems they had when they went in, there was a 12.7 machine gun below the slope from them that was chewing up the aircraft coming in to resupply them. So they decided to get rid of it with hand grenades. So Keith is crawling down closer to the edge, trying to throw hand grenades over the edge and knock out this heavy machine gun. And it hits a tree and bounces back in front of McDowell's position.
Oh, no.
So then crawls over to him to explain to him the idea of grenades is to kill the enemy, not the team. This is called combat counseling. But yeah, really good mission. They came back, and they were still all juiced up when they got back to Da Nang and that. We were sitting in a club. Well, actually, they started in the club, and then somebody told them I'd made a beer run, and I had three cases of Bombie Bomb, my hooch. So they ended up in my hooch for the after the war celebration.
Yes, indeed.
And I got the whole story, and I put it in that chapter. Excellent, excellent mission by RT Idaho. Yeah. And Keith Larson, Jesse, and I, and like Tilt and I, we're still friends to this day.
Indeed.
Because we've got pictures of each other in a hotel room with chickens.
And then moving right along to chapter 5, this is the one, when I read it, I had never heard anything like it. Ghost.
Ghost, or is that the one?
Or which, Windows in the Past?
Windows in the Past, yeah.
With the little people and the snakes.
Oh, yeah. We got lucky, Mac and I. We first of all, there's dry holes, which I only saw once. And that was this particular mission, where you go in and you don't get any contact. It's like a 3-day walk through the woods and that.
Yeah.
And we drew this target. It was on the northwestern edge of the DM, going up where it climbs up into the Laotian Plateau. And we went in. They just wanted to find out what was in the area, because the last after action report had been from 1967. 67. Somebody had been in that, and this is like in 70, 71.
Yeah, yeah.
So we draw the mission, and we get up there, and Boudreau had been a 1-0. He was the launch site NCO. He had been a 1-0 when that mission had gotten run in 67, 68.
No, is that right?
Yeah, but he wasn't on the team, but he remembered the area.
On the ground experience.
And he's giving us a hard time. Yeah, well, you know, the last people were in there, you know, they came out with their tail between their legs, you know, wild stories and all this. So Mac and I get geared up. We get inserted, and nothing. We found some tracks, found mostly barefoot, you know, no sandals, no Ho Chi Minh sandals with the truck tires on the bottom, no Bata boot. These were barefoot natives, so they had to be yards. So, and the yards are all spooky. They're like jittery. You know, something's going on. And, you know, I finally get over by Kuman with Mac. And Mac goes, what's going on? And Kuman goes, oosh, number 10, snake people. Bad peoples. Yard, no like. Tahan, no like. And we're going, okay. So I had to go back and check the team. And as I wandered to the back, I ran into Bong, the shaman. And he's the same way. He's like looking around. He's a lot more composed than the rest of them. But he's sitting there, and I go, Bong, what are the snake people? And he goes, don't say their name. Oh, why is that?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm starting to think all these bad people. I think they're headhunters. Because some of the Brew and some of the Sedang had not been headhunters that long ago. You know, back 10, 15 years before that, they were still taking heads.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the Jirai were like that. So I'm thinking they're headhunters. Yeah, okay. But the yards are spooked. And we don't see any MBA. And I asked Bong, I said, how come no MBA here? And he says, snake people. Snake people. MBA no come here. NBA no come here. Snake people. Bad people. You know, and you keep hearing it. Bad people. Number 10. And we had found this cave that we were going up, we were winding our way up to this cut notch up to the plateau. And it was in the one wall of the gorge. And it was probably 20 meters wide, maybe 10 meters deep. And at the back of it was this, it was all overgrown inside with moss and mildew and shit like that. There was a bunch of poles arranged. And there was the head of a bear, a skull of a bear that was all covered over with mold. And there was a set of what looked like aviator goggles hanging from a center pole, and some other pieces of equipment and bones that looked like human bones. So, and that's really freaked out the yards. Oh, number 10. I started to go in and take a look at it. And Kuman grabbed me like I was holding me back from the edge of a cliff. No, number 10, number 10. So I pulled back and said, well, you know, whatever it is, let's keep moving. So we moved back up the gorge, and we get on top, maybe a half a mile from where we found the cave, and we found the remains of an old prop-driven fighter aircraft. found an engine and then part of the rear part of it. And then the actual fuselage with the cockpit in it was separate, had separated from it with one wing. And I'm up inside of it. You know, most of our fighter aircraft, under the pilot's seat is a survival kit that has like a Silenced 22, and they got emergency rations, and there's a medical kit and gold in the form of chains, right.
And why was that flat there? Coins.
So I'm looking for that stash. And I'm underneath up underneath there, and I find a bunch of crumpled papers that looked like it was a map and a journal and that, and no gold. But laying on the between the runners and that is a clasp knife, and it says Langoli on it. Well, Langoli is the official knife maker for the French Army. It means bumblebee, and the little back of the knife on the back strap is a picture of a bumblebee. So I dug it out of there and I stuck it in my pocket. I still have it to this day somewhere, you know. But and every time I feel bad that I've had bad luck, bad women, bad whiskey, I blame it on the knife and the bad luck.
Indeed.
Yeah. But, we found this old French aircraft. We figured out, we found part of a parachute and a shoe a little further from the airplane. We figured the guy bailed out and the thing bellied in on the plane of jars up there. And the bad peoples got him and either killed him or come across his body, and they put the remains in that cave and that. So we're finally, when we find the aircraft, they tell us, all right, get ready to be extracted, and they direct us to an LZ and that. And we get to the LZ and we get set up. All the way there, the yards are jumpy. You know, like,
and you've never seen that before.
No, never like
even
that.
Even when you're on the ground with contact imminent, you don't see that kind of hinkiness.
Yeah, the Montagnards, I mean, they could go on the ground and Dracula could be there and they wouldn't give a damn.
Yeah.
But whatever it was spooking them in that. We get to the LZ and we, you know, get set up and we're lifting off. As we're lifting off, I look back down on the LZ and there's two Montagnards. Primitives. They're still wearing loincloths. You know, one of them's armed with a crossbow with the, you know, the little quiver and all that. And the other guy was carrying a Mat 49 French submachine gun, circa the 1950s. Whoa. And they had tattoos around their eyes and that, you know, like the Sedang sometimes tattooed themselves like that. And then when we got back, Bong, the shaman, because I had seen him and he had been with me when I seen him, I had to go for a cleansing where he took me down to the yard. Oh, yeah. Took me down to the yard hut and they were burning monkey balls and hair or something and waving it around me, and, you know, putting pennies on my back, you know, and chanting some sort of shit and that. And Mac was, because I couldn't go, I wanted to go downtown and no, we got to fix your spirit so that the bad peoples don't take your spirit and hold it and that. You'll have to stay here and you'll have to drink this horrible concoction and get smoke shoved up your ass. And meanwhile, Cookie and them are heading down to the Pink House and I don't want to go. So they're getting ready to leave and I go, you're going to leave me here like this? And they go, yeah. You know, it's your fault. You saw him. I said, really? Watch this. I turned to Bong and I said, I saw Mac talking to those, to the bad people, and he gave them every Montagnard name. That ended their trip to the Pink House. They're sitting with me suffering through the, oh, you got to be cleansed. Now, we're really weird target. Very, very strange. I mean, obviously they were a Montagnard tribe. But the other Montagnards didn't trade with them. They didn't intermarry with them. And they were all afraid of them. And the North Vietnamese were afraid of them, too.
Yeah, how many areas and around anywhere in Southeast Asia that the NVA didn't go?
I can only remember one other place over on the East Coast in the DM where another small splinter group in that they were the same. Only these were real tall Montagnards, wherever they came from, you know, probably Harlem. But they, but the only two places I remember in Vietnam total that where there was, we didn't operate in there and the North Vietnamese didn't operate in there for some reason. We didn't operate in there because there's nobody to go after.
Right.
You know, and the NVA didn't operate in there, I guess, because they sent somebody in there and they disappeared and they figured, well, we just won't go through there again. You know, very, very strange target.
Indeed. And then I want to go back to your first book just a little bit here because...
For the indictment.
Indeed. But the... bear with me a second here. Because your first mission that for you is your first time on the ground with the team and you're going into the target, there's firefights, and in your mind, it's just like, this is a pretty bad target. And then at the end of it, they they explain to you that
this is an easy one.
And then the other part, too, is like, I want to get back a little bit to your unique relationship with your captain, because you're told that this is a volunteer operation. And so you finally, after you go through your briefing and the triangle, you get your briefing. I guess, did you get your CNC briefing after you arrived at Da Nang?
The Trang was basically, you went through there, that was headquarters.
Right.
Right, and then you went to whatever project you'd been sentenced to. And when you got there, you got briefed by, I remember the day we arrived, you go up to the headquarters, up at the head shed, and they process in all your paperwork. You get to meet the sergeant major for the project, and, the colonel gives you a little rah-rah talk. And then you get sent to either the Hatchet Company or S4 or Hickory, the Camo section, or Recon.
Right.
Depending on which one you'd been assigned to. And then my first meeting with Captain Manus was when I arrived down in Recon Company.
Right. And so this is like, it's funny, but it also gives you a little bit of flavor of some of the characters that you were with there and Captain Manus.
Well, you got to remember that Manus was a prior NCO.
Indeed.
Who had gone to school, learned not to scratch his nuts with the salad fork, and they made him an officer.
Indeed.
Right. So, but if you can imagine a square faced, bull necked, blonde hair, combat soldier, and he'd been a senior NCO before and then got a commission to be a captain. Is there a ghost in the house? No. he was in charge of Recon Company, and it was like, should I relate it, or are you going
to try? Well, I'd like to get into the book because some of the language in it was just so funny. You've arrived at CCN, and they tell you to go down to the Recon Company area, and as we walk up to the orderly room, getting back to the book, we feel, dragging our bags with us. Our guide draws something about waiting outside in the shade until the company commander has a chance to talk with us. He sticks his head in the door and says something to those inside. He suddenly jerks himself out of the way just as the door bursts open and a body flies out, landing in front of us. The man begins to pick himself up, then falls back face first in the sand. He then manages to help himself up and staggers off towards the back of the company area. We stare at the retreating form, wondering what this is all about. And then our heads swing up as the door opens a second time. I'm sorry. This is another little insight. Yeah. So a short, squat, blonde captain is standing in the doorway with his fist balled up. Without blinking an eye, he surveys us. He looks around as if expecting the body that had preceded him to still be there. He has all the charm of a bouncer at an orphanage. He sticks out his jaw, apparently in an attempt to punctuate his next statement. But it fails to delineate if this troll actually has a neck. He takes a breath and starts in. Welcome to Recon Company. I'm Captain Manus. But you may call me Sir, or Motherfucker Sir, or just hide when you think I'm looking for you. I will be assigning you to a team just as soon as I can because we need warm bodies. This is a volunteer organization. If at any time you feel that you can't hack it, all you have to do is come in here and tell me you're the sergeant major and we will reassign you somewhere else. Gentlemen, this is real important. So I hope you have been picking your ears instead of your ass. If you're too shaky to do this job, you don't need to be out there where you can get someone else killed. He pauses, which is good, because I'm trying to figure if this is actually a human being. He gulps a breath. His mouth settles into some sort of grimace that slashes across the square features like a watermark and continues. This is the extent of the briefing, welcoming speech, and pre-dark pep talk. Are there any questions? If there are, there better not be stupid questions because questions and answers time cuts into my leisure activities. So at this point, you're saying, I look at the sand and then he turns to you and you've got a question. So what was your question?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you got to understand, Larry, the way you describe it is the way it's described in the book. You don't get the full effect.
Okay, please fill
us in. When Larry talks, he goes, you can call me sir, you can call me motherfucking sir, or you can just fucking hide when I'm looking for
yeah.
it. You know, and he's got this no neck. Yeah. And I'm sitting there going, I know what this squat bread's all about. And I immediately suspected that he was former NCO.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, the polish is not there. This is not, a military academy project or a product. This is right out of the ranks. So I asked him, I said, this is a voluntary outfit. What was wrong with that guy? He wanted to quit. So why did he want to quit? Because he's a pussy. And I said, but I thought it was a voluntary outfit. And he said, well, let me, what's your name? And I said, Brockhout. And he said, well, listen, Broken Trout. You know, you're obviously some kind of barracks room lawyer, or you've got, you know, some sort of, you know, hidden agenda in that. I'm going to put you on RT Habu, you know, where you can be another burden to society. And maybe between the three of you, you can actually be a real team. So that's how I got assigned to RT Habu, right then and there. So when I showed up in the hooch.
Oh, yeah.
Jimmy Johnson and Mac are in there, and they're cleaning their guns when I walked in the door. And shut the door. We don't want the sunlight in here. Why, is Dracula in here with you? What? And they're cleaning their guns, and they go, Mac looks at me and goes, let me guess. You've run into Captain Manus, and you had a discussion with him, and then he assigned you to us. I go, that's exactly what happened. He says, well, you either annoyed him or he sent you over here to see if, you know, he can make, if we can make something out of you. And that's how I ended up. And then Castro came in right after that.
Castillo.
And, yeah. Castillo comes in and fishes a beer out of the refrigerator and that. And Mac was sitting there cleaning the Silence 22 and shoots the beer can and it starts peeing all over the place and that. And Castro never even breaks stride. He goes, well, that's real good. If you have anything of value, make sure these two don't get their hands on it because they'll bubbify it. But that was my introduction to Habu.
Indeed. Welcome to the team.
Jimmy Johnson and McLaughlin. Well, they must have signed you because he figured that you were going to add some kind of intelligence. In fact, I think Manus said that. That'll make the collective IQ in that hooch 3. yeah, Larry's, and I still love the man.
Indeed.
Well, people don't understand. I mean, the officers that we had, you know, people have read the book and they think that we're, you know, we're a bunch of disorganized, disrespectful, you know, out of control troops in that. Well, we had a lot of respect for our officers because they were victims in our own little demise in that. You know, I mean, they were fellow travelers in that, and they were worse than us. They had some captain come in one time Hey, I think he was with the Marichal division or something. When he got there, he'd read Clausewitz and, you know, Teng Chu and knew all the arts of war. And that, by God, he was going to straighten out Recon Company and get us back in uniform, make us act like an army unit and that. Unfortunately, he did this at the Officers Club. And Manus, I think Taylor was there. Messenger was there.
Uh-huh.
And I think Lightning Wunderlich was there. They decided to save his life. So they got him drunk, and they took him down to the Montagnard shitters. You know, the toilets with the 55-gallon drums. They duct taped him, and then stuck him inside underneath one of the holes. And by morning, he was a babbling idiot. You know, they had... He'd gone completely nuts, had a nervous breakdown and all that. And somebody asked Manus after, why'd you do that? Well, we didn't do it. Probably one of the NCOs did that. Yeah, right. Right. You guys did it to save his life because we would have committed homicide on him. We didn't suffer fools, but at the same time, we had a lot of respect for our officers.
The good ones, particularly.
The good ones, yeah. And then I think of the entire time I was there. I mean, in Recon Company... I can't think of one officer that was a worthless piece of shit. Every single one of them was a good combat officer. And probably because of Manus. Or, see, who was there? Kimmel. Remember Kimmel?
Yes, Larry.
Larry, who the colonel complained because he said that we laid around drunk all the time, so that he wanted Recon to run PT.
No.
So the last day that Larry is in command of Recon Company before he leaves, he leads Recon Company on a run around the perimeter road.
Yeah.
Leading Recon Company wearing nothing but his boots and a cigar. Recon never ran again. That was the end of that. You know, he eventually became a colonel.
Larry did?
Oh, yeah. He was, you know, Hunter Liggett?
Yeah.
He was the commander of Hunter Liggett. He was also, he told me he was the chief ranger in the Grand Canyon. So I mean, I don't know. I mean, I call up his office and everything. I said, I'd like to speak to the head ranger. Who are you? I said, well, I'm a friend of his. Who do you think is the chief ranger? Well, you know, Larry Kimmel. You mean the grounds manager for the North Rim? Oh, yeah. And it turned out it was his boss. Who was the head ranger? A woman.
Oh, no.
Who's actually... Yeah. And I got on the phone with her. And now, Larry never answers the phone.
Right.
20 minutes after I had that conversation with that woman, he was on the phone. Don't ever call my office again. Don't ever talk to anybody. Do tell. Good people, though. Bowray.
Captain Gary Robb.
Oh, yeah, but Bowray, first time Thompson. I saw Bowray, he was a second lieutenant. He was washing the Jeep I'd stolen the night before,
right?
Yeah.
And, of course, he stayed in and rose to a two-star general two-star. Over time.
I think he was a three-star. No, I think he got out as a three-star.
Left as a two, trust me.
There was another guy who was an NCO and became a major general in the Marine Corps, Allen or something like that?
Sam Hall. He ran out of CCC.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And... he rose high in the ranks of the Marine Corps.
Yeah. And, he was a general. I remember that.
Yes, he was. And then...
Eldon was a staff sergeant.
Well, we were E4s together at FOB1 in the early days.
And look at Mo Elmore. You know? He was a half-assed decent staff sergeant and then he became a colonel.
Well, we'll get back to a little bit of action here regarding your very first mission where you just got on a team... You did your training. You get the go order. They change things around. Max the 1-0. You're the 1-1. And they did a multiple team insertion, or at least they wanted it to appear that way. And then you guys get into the target. And then after the insertion, your guys are on the ground. First night, you set up an RON.
Right.
And then you're on the ground for a while. And I think... the next day is when you begin to make enemy contact?
Yeah, well, the other teams got in. They inserted three teams.
All at Once, which is...
All at Once, which is a no-no. I mean, yeah. And obviously it was Fubai, because Pappy Boudreaux would never do that up at
Out of Quantry, right.
That was Dover in that crowd. But they put us in. We were at the far, far end. We were the last team that went in. And the next morning, the other teams start getting rolled up. One right after the other. And we got hit last. And it was... suddenly we had people all over us, coming from everywhere. And the reason, the whole thing boils down to this. We were fighting for what I thought was our lives. That it was a desperate situation, and the yards were performing perfectly. I was doing what I had to do, and it was the first time that Mac and I had actually been in combat together. So it was kind of the Vulcan mind meld between the two of us. And we got done with the thing, and Max telling me, he says, well, that worked out good. So what do you mean worked out good? We're alive, but I didn't think we accomplished anything. He said, no, this was training. This is a chance for the Montagnards to see how well you operated under stress before we get a tough target. Well, I'm looking at the thing. I mean, I was down. When we pulled out, I think I had like 3 magazines left. And I normally carried a load of anywhere between, well, I carried 6 30-round magazines. And
back then you had 30 rounds. We didn't have those luxuries.
Yeah, well, we got them because Castillo, the Cuban.
The Cuban.
Found a source for them. And we stole that source away from them. But we ended up with a truckload of the things. And everybody had them. They were making them. The Filipino marmers are making them up in making 30 and 40 round magazines up at the S4.
Was that right?
And they worked pretty good. The
even the 40 round?
The 41 round would jam.
Yeah.
I give it. I never used the 40.
It's a long push for a spring.
Yeah. But in this particular mission was basically, I thought it was a tough mission. And Mac just basically says, no, you did well. The yards like you. They think you're number one. They like the fact you have dialogue when you're screaming. And you're in. It's like getting elected to Boys Club. But that was a tough mission, I thought, and it soon proved. Looking back on it now, it was a cakewalk by comparison. I mean, after I did my first bright light,
right?
That's when I realized that this shit could get real serious real quick.
So your first bright light was how many missions into your time with Mac with Habu at that time?
I think the third or fourth.
And so what was the bright light for specifically?
Went in to get a team was shot up. The 1-0 was shot up. The 1-1, I think it's covered in there as Blue Eyes. Where the chopper went down, the 1-0 was thrown into the river when the chopper went down. The 1-1 was shot up real bad. And we went in to find the 1-0 and the crew. And when we got there, the chopper had burned. And the door gunner, all I remember about him, he had really brilliant blue eyes. And that was the only thing that was unmarked on him. He was completely charred up, burned right down to the bones.
Oh.
And when I went to check him out, he opened his eyes and no more eyelids. They were just burnt crust there. And he opened his eyes and looked at me, and it freaked me out. And I went to give him a morphine, kill him, because there's nothing there to save. And then Max stopped me. He said, save it. We may need the morphine later.
Well,
there's nothing there. He doesn't even feel pain anymore. It's all gone. And sometimes I close my eyes, I can still see that guy. But that was the worst thing about going in on aircraft was, especially if they burn.
Oh, yes. It's horrible.
Bad scene. But that was the first bright light was Blue Eyes, I think. Pretty sure that was the first one.
Yes, according to the book.
Yeah, that was the one that was west of Da Nang because we launched off the PSP strip there.
Right there at Da Nang.
Yeah.
So it's one of the lower targets in the Prairie Fire AO.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny, Fubai was always getting sucked in.
right.
weather-wise. And that. And then they'd run things out of Da Nang because you could still get out in the AO. And that. And a lot of times Fubai was in transition over something. The only launch site that ran like clockwork was Quantre. And that was because Pappy Boudreau was up there.
Nobody messed with Pappy.
Oh, who's going to mess with the Buffalo?
Yeah.
Yo, Major Slatten was in charge. And the medic and Boudreau were giving him some kind of pharmaceutical cocktail. He didn't even know what century he was in. Here, sign these papers, sir. Yeah. Yeah, I'm running this place ever. Sure you are. But Pappy wouldn't let you go in. If he didn't have enough helicopters to get you out, he wouldn't put you in. But bottom line, Fubai, they'd put three teams in and only have enough choppers and air support to get one out. And that's when, and most of the bright lights, the hairy ones we ran were out of Fubai, or one of their boxes and that. Yeah, and that after that first mission, I realized after the first bright light that first mission really was a cakewalk by comparison. Because bright light will tighten your ass up.
Yeah. And again, you'll go in heavy, like you said, with an RPD, with your Car 15 strapped to your back, and then in the early days you had your shotgun sawed off until somebody stole it.
I would have taken in a mini nuke if I thought I'd get away with it. I'm just, that you're going in, you're going to shoot your way in, grab up all the survivors, and shoot your way back to the helicopters, hopefully intact, and get out. That's bright light in its essence. Hopefully gathering up all the dead bodies. I think I went on one bright light where nobody was there. There were a lot of dead people.
Right.
We picked up a flight crew that was, they hadn't booby-trapped the place. They hadn't set up an ambush waiting for us to come back. They just killed them and left. But usually there was lots of people there and they were using any survivors as bait to try and kill more of you.
Indeed. Yes. I'd like to just go back. At the very beginning of your book, you talk a little bit about the formation of where this all began. And which you talked about earlier, but the writing here captures some of the history. And let's like to take a few paragraphs and get into that for a little bit more reflection after this, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
This book is first of two detailing the actions and experiences of a small group of Americans and their indigenous allies who were the backbone of ground reconnaissance to the Republic of Vietnam during the war. The unit that's described here was part of MAC VSOG, Military Assistance Command Studies and Observations Group. Or just SOG. In the 8 years that it existed, the small recon companies that were the center of its activities conducted some of the most dangerous and daring missions of the war. Originally conceived as a unit capable of infiltrating the heart of the area controlled by the North Vietnamese in both Laos and Vietnam, it expanded its reach to North Vietnam, Cambodia, and a few other places best left unmentioned. During that time, companies never exceeded more than 30 Americans, yet they were the best source for the enemy's disposition and were key to U.S. military being able to take the war to the enemy through the air and on the ground. This was accomplished by utilizing new and innovating technology, but also heavily relied on the ability of the individual team members being able to use tactics as old as those from the French and Indian Wars. In that process, this small unit racked up one of the most impressive records of awards for valor of any unit in the history of the United States Army. It came at a terrible price, however. The number of wounded and killed in action resulted in the computation of a life expectancy that was measured in a matter of a few months. Those missions today seem suicidal. In 1970, they seemed equally so. Yet, these men went out day after day with their indigenous allies, consisting of Montagnard tribesmen, Vietnamese and Chinese Nungs, and faced the challenges with courage and resolve. After the fall of the Republic of Vietnam, the indigenous survivors faced persecution and, in some cases, wholesale execution. Today, the Montagnard minority is still being persecuted by the central government, as their traditional life is being robbed along with the resources of their homelands in the mountains of Vietnam and Laos. In the end, the communist regimes seemed determined to wipe out these amazing people. And that's just a little bit of a commentary. But first, it goes back to an aspect of the war of the little people we left behind and just how courageous they were. And what today is you have some reflections back on those times with those people. And I know we've had some Montagnard communities that are have been able to flourish in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and I think there's one in Minnesota. I'm not sure about that one.
The one in Minnesota is also Hmong, not just Montagnard, but it's Hmong.
Hmong also, okay.
And the two guys that run Save the Dega People
right.
get all the kudos in the world. Those guys have done a magnificent job over the years. Actually, bringing the survivors and establishing communities here in the United States, and the communities have prospered. Their children have gone to college. They, as diverse, they become doctors, lawyers. They own their own furniture companies. One of them is actually a 747 pilot, one of the children.
And they have a Green Beret.
And and they become part of the fabric of our country. And they deserve to be. You know, the Yards gave everything to our effort. The Yards stayed loyal to us. The Yards, I had Montagnards lay on top of me to keep me from being hit again. I mean, when you go through something like that, that's a bond with the people that you don't forget. Like I always tell people, I wear this bracelet because I will be Brew until the day I die. And I am. And most of the guys I know, we have an undying love for those people and would do anything for them. And they, in turn, remain loyal to us. What was unique about the unit, though, was some of the numbers. In the 8 to 9 years, that from 1964 to 1973, basically, that the unit existed.
When the unit ended, it still existed.
Right, it still existed. But they, something like 8,600 people served in it as ground combat operations. That's not the Ash and Trash, the S-4, the shoe clerks down in the Trang and that, but the guys who actually ran the missions in that 8 years was something like around 6,000 or 7,000. And only 1,800 of us survived the war. 1,800 out of that number survived the war. And give you an idea of the casualty. I didn't know anybody. I think I knew one guy that never got wounded. Everybody else was wounded 1, 2, 3 times. Most of us was not even righted up. Because you'd always get in bomb trash and shrapnel and stuff in that area. Unless you're like Chaffee and, you know, you got 9 Purple Hearts because you're right up every single time you got scratched. No, or like Kerry, he's another one.
Yes.
You know. But, you know, most guys didn't go after him. Most of the guys weren't metal hunters, what we called them. You know, there's a few. I know one guy that actually wrote up his Silver Star citation before he got on the helicopter.
Oh, my God.
But if you read the after-action reports from the mission before that, and he did all those things and did them again, which would have been qualified for valor and, you know, a valorous gallant award, and that was Silver Star, so he wrote up the Silver Star. He was a strange guy, though.
Indeed.
And most of the time, like with Mac wrote me up for 2 Bronze Stars and a Silver Star. I never got the Silver Star. Because when they closed the project out, it was still pending, and the C-21 that was carrying all the records back flew into the side of a mountain down near Nha Trang. Murphy actually ran the bright light on the plane crash.
Was that right?
Yeah, he said there was paperwork scattered all up in the trees and that, so they just naped the entire area and scorched it to the ground in that. And Mac and Cook tried to submit a later one. I said, hey, give it up, man. You know, that's the thing. I know what I did, and it wasn't that heroic. And if you're trying to get me an award, I suspect you're up to something. So I didn't bother with it. But you've got a lot of guys that have gone back and, you know, tried to get their awards updated. There's a certain class of those people now that are trying to, I got a silver star, but I'm not happy with that. I should have a medal of honor.
Yeah.
And it just cheapens the award. You got a silver star, be happy with that. You earned that silver star.
You're home now.
You're home now. You know, you don't earn, you don't deserve a DSC. You don't deserve a medal of honor. Be happy with what you got and the fact that you got peers that love and respect you up to this point.
Yeah. This is the vital part of the conversation. But anyways, I want to get back, mention their first book, We Few. The second book, Whispers in the Tall Grass. And these are excellent. They're well written. The stories about SOG, Recon, one of our finest teams, and but also written with a style and panache that is second to none. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to get in the near future, sir, if you got a little extra time here to talk about your third book. And just The Vagabonds. Took my glasses off here. Taurus to the heart of darkness.
That's it. Details my time as an exotic dancer in the Philippines. And that unfortunate that incident when you surrendered with that waitress dream? At a truck stop in Montana.
That's when you surrendered your dream of being a porn star?
That would be the one.
Okay.
Vagabonds was a collective effort between myself and a gentleman named Jeff Miller. Jeff Miller and I met after Vietnam and were in the 10th Special Forces Group together. And then,
which was assigned where at the time?
At Fort Devens, Massachusetts. And our swan song was the Iran hostage raid. You know, we both got out at the same time after the second one collapsed.
And, really?
Oh, you know, we were both of us were involved in the first one on the peripheral, and then on the second one, I was going in with one of the assault teams. And Miller was actually on the first one. He handled moving all those CH-53s around so the Russians wouldn't find out what we were doing. That's how they ended up with the Sea Stallions instead of the Jolly Greens. The Jolly Greens have the filters that keep the dust out of the engines. The Sea Stallions didn't, which was a major failure.
Oh, yeah.
But it was all done to keep the Russians from telling the Iranians, they're coming. You know, so, but when we got out, we formed a friendship that's lasted 50-some years. And we were doing things that eventually developed into the contractor industry. In those days, you go found somebody, convinced him that he needed something, and then showed up at his doorstep as the answer to his problem. And we did a lot of that. We did kidnap recoveries in the Middle East, in Chechnya, in Mexico, Brazil, Colombia. We did, police forces in the United States under the International Association of Chiefs Police, SWAT seminars. We did training for foreign countries like Taiwan, Korea, Colombia, Brazil, a couple of other places, best not unmentioned, to train special groups, you know, police and or military. What else did we do? Computers verified.
Well, let's just get people to converted. Will your book be available for a pre-order?
Yeah, it's available now. It's on Amazon.
Tell us. So Vagabonds is on Amazon now.
It is on Amazon. You can pre-order.
All right. Yeah. And as we get down here at the end, any last closing thoughts, anything you want to add or something we should cover? Just, it's your time.
Give me a moment.
I'll give you 2 moments if you like.
No, I'm pleased to be here. I'm glad you guys have me in. There's so much to talk about with Special Projects.
Indeed.
Because Special Projects is the backbone of what we have now. The things that we did, that we conceived, and that we nurtured and then handed off to the next generation is what makes Special Operations so good today. Because we imbued in them not only the technical aspects, but the fact that you have to be a bit of a bastard child in order to survive in this business. And that was the one thing that I felt very proud of, was the fact that group has always nurtured that. up until recently when all the carpetbaggers and when they made it a branch.
Right.
That's what ruined it. Because now an officer could come in and stay in the branch. Before, you were an infantry officer, artillery officer, chemical officer. You came to Special Forces, you punched your ticket, you moved on, and then you came back after you made field grade. Today, they grow up in, I think, in a bubble. But the teams are the same. I've talked to a lot of enlisted men over the years and at different places. One thing that holds true, no matter how dark the night, no matter how dangerous the mission, if you show up at an MSS full of special forces with purloined booze and steaks, you're welcomed with open arms, as if you're a relative. And if you have ammo, you get extra points.
Indeed. Yeah. And it's true. At the team level today, we've had the honor of meeting some of these team members at different groups in recent months. And the young men that wear the funny-looking hat that keeps neither the rain nor the sun out of your eyes are the highest quality, perhaps a little bit better than we were in our day, Nick.
Oh, but they're smarter, better educated. Now, I promised you I would never tell this.
Indeed, you promised. But now that we're on live...
I ran into the team sergeant and the team when I was selling armored cars over in Iraq, who had found Hussein and Hussein's private car collection. And they were selling them through the Kurds back into Germany and places like that. And they were taking the money and using it to pay their intel contacts. And the reason they were doing that was because when they got money from the military, a bunch of mucks up there at MI and that, and over at the post office in Langley, when they get money from them, they had to write down who they gave it to, what the address was, what was for and that. And they were getting they weren't getting info anymore because the opposition was killing them off because they had the phones tapped, or they knew some State Department guy, or they were sleeping with some State Department guy and got the information. So that innovativeness was still there.
Indeed.
They took that money from the sale of those cars, and they were paying their agents in hard cash. They didn't take one dime for themselves. They didn't take one dime to buy one case of booze or anything like that. Everything went back into the op fund. And for that, I feel extremely proud to know those guys.
Indeed.
I promised I wouldn't tell. I didn't give up your names, John.
Yes, we will. But not today. We'll come back for a second session on the names to be given up. Well, Nick, thanks for joining us today. And again, the three books are amazing reading. Just go to Nick Brockhausen and Amazon.com and take a look at the book. And there's many stories in there. We just scratched the surface, as Jocko would say, on this busy day. And we thank you for joining us. So at this point, I want to thank Jocko for having us do podcast number 3 today and have an outstanding guest like this. We have more coming up soon. And as we close out, we want to thank today's service members, our first responders, everybody who's on the front lines, particularly with these times with the virus, and anybody in between, firefighters and... If I forget anybody, Nick, who do you think? Well, that thought will close, and we'll be back.
And ships at sea.
Ships at sea, indeed. Thank you, and until next time, God bless. God bless America.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each, then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.